Good evening, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. This is your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm excited to have an old friend and former BBS radio show hostess back tonight. Her name is Liz Miller. Liz is a healer, shaman, Hatha yoga teacher, world traveler, filmmaker, and talented disc jockey in her home country, Australia. She just ended a wonderful spiritual journey around the world to visit as many of the known and unknown sacred sites as possible, and we'll probably be talking about some of that and whatever else comes up. So let's welcome Liz to the show now, and hi, Liz. How are you?
I'm great, Lance. How are you?
Oh, well, I've got a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to let you do most of the talking tonight.
Okay, we can work with that.
Well, you've been a busy girl since we went to Mount Shasta together.
Yes, I have. I've spent another couple of months on the road after I saw you, and I've been home now for nearly 3 months.
Now, would you like to talk about your travels and you know, get into some of that, or, you know, what you found when you were traveling? Because you went to some pretty interesting places.
I sure did. I would love to talk about my travels. The whole trip that I took, which, as you, I think, mentioned, was 4 months long, or if people don't know, I was on the road for 4 months, was really all about learning to step into the light of my truth and really accepting and trusting who I was. I was traveling, or who I am, I was traveling on my own for the most part, except for the last month when I met up with a friend in India. And I did go to some very interesting places. A lot of them weren't on the map. And there were some incredible initiations and activations that I received at some of those places. So I'm happy to talk about any of that. You just ask away.
Well, you told me one story about a place that you went to see that you had difficulty getting to, and the taxi driver was driving on this road that was half on the cliff and half off of it. and then you got to it, and there was this amazing arch or door or something. Can you talk about that one?
Actually, that's two different places that I went to in that little introduction there.
Okay.
The first place was a place in Peru called, well, actually both of them were places in Peru. The first place was called Macahuasi, and it was a place that I'd seen on the internet at least 2 or 3 years ago, and I remember at the time just exploding with excitement at the possibility that one day I might actually get to go to this place. It's 14,000 feet above sea level, deep in the Andean Mountains. And from Lima, it's a 5-hour drive. So it's not the easiest place to get to. And when you don't speak Spanish, as I don't, very little Spanish, you have to just trust that you're going to be taken by the right people. And one of the things that I did throughout the whole trip was I'd wake up every day and I would say, I am magic, I am miracles. And every day magic and miracles would happen. And I really took it on board and accepted that as part of my reality. And the more that I did that, the more magic and more miracles happened. But in this particular instance, it wasn't so much about magic and miracles, although, you know, in hindsight, I think I can say that that portion of the trip was extremely important in teaching me about listening to my intuitive impulses and messages. And one of the things that I was told before I went away was that the trip would be most successful when I listened and trusted what I was getting intuitively. And so as much as I wanted to go to Macahuasi, on the morning itself, I went, it's quite a long story, but
it's a good
basically
one,
I met up with a taxi driver who had, a proper yellow taxi, and he'd been driving me around the day before, and I told him that I was trying to get to this place. He'd never even heard of it, and most Peruvians actually have never heard of Macahuasi. So the next morning, we got up bright and early, and he drove me around to all of the bus stations in Lima, and tried to find me a bus that might be able to take me there. As it turned out, there were no buses that could take you to this place because it was so remote. And he could see that I was terribly disappointed. I was really, really gutted, actually, because I wanted to go to this place so much. And this was my last day in Lima before I had to take a plane to go into the Amazon jungle and spend a week there on a yoga retreat. So time was of the essence, and I'd basically resigned myself to the fact that I would just have to do a bit of shopping and retail therapy to make up for it in Lima instead. When he rang me back about 10:30 in the morning, he dropped me off and said goodbye, and he rang me back and said, look, I found someone who can drive you there, but it's going to cost you this amount of money, which was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought about it, and I thought, you know what, I could buy a really nice pair of sunglasses, or I could go on this trip. What would I rather do? Well, obviously, I'm going to take the trip.
Yeah.
So he and his friend came back to pick me up, and we stopped basically every half an hour to have them lean out the window and say, where do we go next to get to this place? And people all along the way would send us in the right direction, basically.
Huh.
And finally, we made our way higher and higher up into the Andes, and the higher up we went, the less amount of safety precautions were taken along the road, and we were just on really narrow dirt roads that looked like etchings in the side of the mountains, you know, because the mountains are just giant. And these tiny little etchings were what we were using to get higher and higher.
Oh, geez.
And finally, we got to about 10 minutes away from Makawasi, and we'd been going on dirt roads now for about 2.5 hours, so it was very bumpy, very uncomfortable, and pretty scary every time I looked out the window and looked down. And I was with two strangers who I really didn't know, but I felt like, you know, they'd be okay and all that sort of stuff. But heading, while we were actually heading out of Lima, I started to get these really strange feelings in my gut, like, you shouldn't be going, don't do this, this isn't going to work out. You're going to get there and there's going to be clouds on top of the mountain, you're not going to be able to see anything, because in Lima it's very, very foggy all year round.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, God, what if I get all the way up to the top of this mountain? And the last bit of the trek was actually to climb on a donkey for an hour to get right to the top, and have the whole place just fogged in. What if I don't see anything? But I asked them a couple of questions about the weather, and they kept saying, no, it'll be summer where we're going, it'll be fine. And sure enough, the clouds did clear, and, and I started to feel a bit better about it. But I couldn't really discount the fact that I'd had these intuitive impulses. And up until that time in the trip, I'd really been following my gut, and everything had been flowing. There was synchronicity everywhere. It was just amazing. If I needed something, someone would appear and say, can I help you? So, as much as I was really excited, and that was what really overrode all of my feelings that maybe I shouldn't be doing this, we forged ahead, and it was a really exciting part of the trip. Just going up the mountain itself was exciting.
I would think.
And we got to about 10 minutes away from Makawasi, and I could actually feel the energy of this place. And I remember looking up at the mountains, and I was overcome with this sense of anticipation and excitement. And it was like I could actually taste the energy of the place because it was so powerful.
Mm.
And one of the most interesting aspects to this location is that it's on a plateau on top of a mountain, and there's a stone forest where the rocks look as though they've been carved, and at different times of the day, depending on what kind of light there is, you can see faces, you can see different animal shapes, you can see all kinds of really interesting things that, you know, at some point you could say, wow, is this actually intentional? Is this carved?
Uh-huh.
Or is this just a trick of the light and my eyes just playing tricks on me? But I believe that this is one of the oldest ceremonial centers in the world.
Wow.
And I've been told that the Hyperboreans, who were the very first humans to ever settle the earth, actually lived at this place, used it as a ceremonial center, and made these carvings.
Wow.
So they are potentially millions of years old.
Wow.
And so, you know, given all of that, I just had to get there. And when I could feel it, you know, I was just so excited. But what happened was we kept driving, and 20 minutes after that, I started to get this really deep sinking feeling that we'd overshot, because up there were no people to ask. You know, we were probably an hour away from the last person that we'd actually seen on the road, and there were definitely no other cars. And my driver took a left turn when I really very strongly knew that we were meant to turn right.
Uh-oh.
But because I couldn't speak very good Spanish, and I was trusting that they knew where they were going,
yeah.
I didn't really say anything, but I just started to get really worried, and we turned left, and maybe another 5 or 10 minutes up the road, I absolutely knew we'd gone the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
And I just put out a prayer to the universe to for someone to come and help. And just up on the road, there was this little shaman kind of looking man sitting on the edge of the road in the middle of nowhere, 14,000 feet above sea level.
Mm.
Well, I don't know where he came from, but I'm absolutely convinced that he's one of my guides who just took on physical form at that moment to give us some assistance. And the driver stopped, and he said, you know, where are you going? And our driver said, we're trying to find Makawasi. And he said, you've gone the wrong way. You've got to turn back. And so I was just so relieved. We started back, and as soon as we went back, my driver took a pothole a little too fast, and it was boiling hot as well. It was the middle of the day.
Oh, no.
And we got a flat tire.
Oh,
and I remember thinking, what is going to happen now? We're going to die. If no one comes, we could potentially quite easily die here. And coming from Australia, when people get stranded out in the middle of, you know, the bush, people die. We had really similar conditions. It was very hot, you know, during the day, cold at night, and I was the only one who'd thought to bring some water. So I thought, okay, this is fine. We'll just change the tire. When we tried to change the tire, there were the wrong number of holes in the actual tire. So we had a tire, but we couldn't actually put it on the car.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was like this hysterical comedy of errors, and things just kept kind of going wrong, and I felt like I was a little bit felt like I was with Dumb and Dumber, you know, and these two guys were scratching their heads. And luckily they went off and found some help, and long story short, I was within licking distance of Makawasi, and I didn't get there.
Oh,
and so that was a really powerful lesson for me to use the rest of the journey to never ever do that again.
Yeah.
To really trust whatever I was feeling, no matter how crazy it was.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I did that. Now, the Stargate that I went to, which was also in Peru, which was the place that you mentioned just before, I went to maybe a couple of weeks after I was at Makawasi, and the same hands, whoever was responsible for the rock carvings at Makawasi, are also responsible for the Stargate that I saw just near Puno, near Lake Titicaca in Peru. And that was another place that I was just as excited about. And I knew that there was some intentional, molding of the structures, because the mountains in that area were absolutely like normal mountains, smooth and undulating, giant, beautiful, majestic things.
No.
But just at this one place where the Stargate is, and this Stargate is like a huge dimensional doorway that's literally carved out of the rock.
Wow.
So standing in front of it, you would look up 7 meters, and that's how high the doorway was.
Now for us,
and in the middle of the doorway was a smaller doorway that a human could stand in, and right in the center of that doorway was a circular indentation, which looks very much like a keyhole.
Ooh.
And it is a doorway to other dimensions. It's been used for countless thousands of years. by people who practice white magic as well as black magic. So it's a place where you need to be careful. You need to do your protections and all that sort of stuff, but you can certainly use this space as a portal to visiting other realms. And so as we were approaching the Stargate, I noticed that this particular mountain actually looked like a cathedral, and there were spires and parts of it that looked like they'd been moulded, and it was all jagged and shocking looking, you know, like compared to the rest of the landscape. It was just amazing. And this was somewhere where no problems occurred. And I was lucky enough to find someone who knew where to take me. And again, this is a place where not very many of the locals even know about. It's called the Aramu Muru Stargate.
Okay.
And when I got there, I was just totally blown away. And I did some prayers of protection and stood in the doorway. And I'd been told that I was to put my hands in either corner of the doorway, both feet in either corner below me, and my belly button, which I thought was very interesting, went up against that circular indentation in the doorway.
Isn't that
funny? You know, it reminds me of Pakal's tomb lid, where you see him. It looks, you know, in Eric von Daniken's movie Stargate of Chariots of the Gods, he went to Palenque and filmed this tomb lid, and I don't know if you've seen it, but it looks as though he's flying a kind of spaceship, basically. But out of his middle, there's a column of light that is basically connecting him to the galactic core. You don't see the connection to the galactic core, but if you read some of the interpretations, Jose Arguelles mentions that chakra at the solar plexus area is the one that connects us to the galactic core, which is called the Hunabku. And so as I was putting my own belly button up against this circular indentation, I felt a little bit like Pakal. And I felt like I was going to go on a trip. But I have to say, I was forewarned maybe a little bit too much about the safety precautions that I needed to take. Right. And I actually think I said too many prayers of protection because when I ended up standing in the doorway, I did hear music coming out of the rock, which was incredible to hear. And I definitely had a sensation of moving through the rock, but there was a part of me that was holding back a little bit because I was alone and I was with someone, again, who I didn't know, who I'd hired to drive me there. And I was actually afraid that if I disappeared into the rock, I wouldn't have anyone to pick me up when I got back. But that was an amazing experience, and I'll definitely go back there. And I'm sure that if I want to next time, I'll go somewhere pretty amazing. But no, the fact that I was just there felt special enough, and very much an initiation and an activation that I know the energies that I experienced in that place definitely shifted something within me. And everywhere that I went, that happened, you know. It could have been, you know, a temple in India or a bus shelter in the States. You know, everywhere that I went, I felt as though I was receiving all kinds of initiations in different ways. And the whole Peru part of the trip definitely culminated just a day later when I went to Bolivia, to La Paz, and went to the site called Tiwanaku. And that was really the place where everything sort of came together. And again, I just followed my intuition. I knew that I had to go to this place. I'd been told in a reading before I left that there'd be a gift waiting for me there. And I perhaps foolishly thought that it might be something physical, that it might be some like an object that would be waiting there for me.
Right.
But the you know, the way that a woman feels when you're traveling alone in a country where you don't speak the language, You don't really understand all of the customs and all that sort of stuff. You know, it can be a little bit scary. And you are tested a lot of the time, especially in your interactions with men.
Yeah.
And a lot of the interactions that I had the whole time I was away were with men, because men seem to be in, like, service industries where I would need to call on them for certain things, or just to interact with them in the street. And so I was constantly observing how I was interacting with men and how they were sort of, I don't know, bouncing off my energy and all that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so I've had to rely on a series of men to get me to these places, you know. And pretty much for the most part, I really can't think of one time actually where, maybe in India right at the end, there were some times where I didn't feel completely comfortable with the males who were around me. But for the most part, all of the male energy that I experienced on the trip was completely supportive, completely loving, and completely accepting of who I was.
Oh, wow.
And that was a really beautiful thing to experience, because you want to feel that as a woman, you know?
Exactly.
You really want that. And you don't want to go into the fear. And as much as I possibly could, I didn't let myself go into the fear mode very often at all. So I got into myself, you know, through the help of a series of men to this very remote place again, across the border from Peru, about 60 kilometers away from the border into Bolivia. And as I was walking towards the Moon Gate, which, and Tiwanaku is at least 12,000 years old, and the structures there, there are pyramids, there are temple spaces, they're just incredible.
Oh,
and
really?
Yeah, the place hardly gets any visitors. So I pretty much had it to myself, you know. There were only a few scattered individuals walking around the rest of the site, and the site is huge. So at one point I remember thinking, I've got to find the Moon Gate, you know, I want to find my gift. How am I going to find it? This place is vast. And just at that time, three men appeared. Two of them were tourists and they had a guide with them, and one of them came up to me and said, is there anything we can help you with? And so I kind of laughed to myself, thinking, I just love the way this kept happening. And I said, yeah, I need to find the Moon Gate, can you help me? And so their guide directed me in the right direction, and I set off. And it was the most beautiful day. I could see all of the mountains all around me in the distance. I could see a pyramid off to my right.
Whoa.
And far off in the distance, I caught my first glimpse of the Moon Gate. And as I was walking towards it, I remember this feeling of immense gratitude filling my whole being. And it was more powerful than any other feeling of gratitude I'd ever had before. And I said out loud, look at where you are, Liz. And I just looked around, like, kind of half stunned, you know, because it all kind of dawned on me in that moment that I'd managed to get myself to this place that I'd always wanted to see. I had it basically to myself, and
wow,
it felt really, really special. I was completely amazed at how I'd been able to make this all happen in the first place.
Yes, yes, it's amazing.
But I was basking in the reality of it as well, and just totally feeling empowered and living my authentic truth.
Wow.
And living a dream, you know.
It was just
living a dream.
Yeah, exactly.
And in that moment, I said it again, look at where you are, Liz. And promptly burst into tears and just felt amazing, just so amazing. And in that moment, I realized that was the gift that my guardians had told me would be waiting there for me.
Wow.
And I'd had, like I said, a few, you know, moments of, you know, the first couple of weeks of the trip, there was amazing, magical, incredible things happening, but there were some moments where I didn't fully trust my intuition and things didn't go quite the way that I'd hoped they would. And in this moment, I realized that from that moment on, I wouldn't have that happen anymore
because
I'd sort of broken through something within myself where I totally accepted and trusted who I was. And as much as I thought that I'd done that before, it was only in that moment that I realized I'd sort of stepped into a new level of mastery.
Wow.
And acceptance.
Wow.
That I was a great being of light.
Wow.
And that I was completely connected to my guides, to my higher intelligence, to my soul family,
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, even higher levels of consciousness and dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And all I needed to do was accept and trust that.
Uh-huh.
And as I would do that, that's really when everything just started to flow in the most beautiful and miraculous ways. So, yeah, that's a little bit about Peru and the start of the trip and how it changed my life.
Wow, that's amazing. There's a wealth of wisdom in there, you know. That's such a magical place to have that experience. And, you know, it's sad that there are many people who don't have that experience, you know, of trusting themselves.
Yeah, I know. And part of what I feel very strongly is that I was having that experience for many others who couldn't have that experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I documented the whole trip. I even documented that time when I burst into tears. Because I really wanted to try and capture every single thing, good or bad, so that I could share these experiences with those who couldn't.
Oh, wonderful.
And at some point there will be a film that I make about
trip
and about the feelings and breakthroughs that I had all along the way.
Oh, wonderful. You know, I remember I met you at the very beginning of your trip when you came to visit and we drove to Mount Shasta. And I was just amazed at your ability to stay focused with keeping your film going. And we met that amazing crystal lady at the crystal shop.
Oh, wasn't that the most incredible afternoon?
My gosh, that was magical. I mean, it was like getting a 20-year education in one afternoon. She just mesmerized both of us, and you got it all on the video.
And that's actually one of the very first things that I'll be uploading. I'll be
putting
that onto YouTube next week.
Oh, wonderful.
I've just been waiting to resolve a few technical issues, but now they are basically in the process of being completely resolved, and as soon as they are, I'll be uploading that film.
Oh, wonderful. I can't wait to see that again. And then the wonderful interview you did with Amora Kuan Yin.
Yes, Amora Kuan Yin was that morning, actually, and we spent an hour with her at her home.
Yeah, and you can see me shaking because I'm holding the camera part of the time.
Oh, yes, you were the cameraman for that entire interview.
Yes, I was. I was so fascinated by it, I forgot momentarily that I was holding a camera, and I was just amazed at the information she was sharing with us, and that's going to be another great video.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
And we were very fortunate to be able to spend that time with her. I felt so lucky, especially as she's someone whose writing has deeply influenced me and my whole way of looking at life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if it weren't for her book, Pleiadian Perspectives on Human Evolution, then I'm not really sure which path I would have taken when I first wanted to investigate my own connections to the Pleiadians. And so it really felt a lot like coming home, you know, being able to spend some time with her and just feel her energy, because being in the same space as her, she just radiates and exudes this incredible energy, doesn't she?
Absolutely, absolutely.
She's such a sweetheart. You know, I was terribly intimidated, I must admit, before I met her.
Well, I was a little myself, but, you know.
But
I,
she was just a complete darling from the moment
she opened the door.
And the way that she shared such intimate parts of herself was a real honor to be around and to experience.
And, you know, there was nothing inauthentic about her. I mean, I didn't have the sense that there was anything frivolous being added. She was speaking from the deepest core part of her heart, from her being, and that it was all, you know, this was her living expression of the divine. And it's just, it's amazing because, you know, she talked about having integrity and not lying and so on and so forth. And there's a wealth of material in there that I know people will get a lot from.
Yeah, they certainly will. So that'll definitely be the second thing that I upload onto YouTube.
Yes, definitely. Now you from Bolivia. Now you hit several other places. You went to France. You went to Egypt. You went to the United Kingdom. You went to India.
Yes, Mexico, Venezuela.
Yes. What would you like to kind of take us on a broomstick ride around the world with you? Or would you like to hit the high parts? Or what's in
well,
your mind?
Well,
get your show.
Okay,
to. You just share whatever you want to.
All right. Oh, gosh, there's so much. It's really, really hard to know,
well, you know
where to
begin. I'm often curious about India because I think I'm like other people. We have so many misconceptions about it and preconceived notions. Does it feel that there's a strong spiritual center there, that people really do have a deeper sense of spirit in that country, or is
well,
that just...
To be quite honest, I didn't get that feeling.
Okay.
It was interesting to see India the way that I did, because in all of the other places that I visited, I went for very specific places or people and or events, like Seattle. I learnt sound healing with Tom Kenyon, and I was very much on a path, and I knew exactly what was involved beforehand. With India, I met up with a friend of mine, and we sort of did the tourist thing. I had spent so much time and energy researching all the other places that I wanted to go to prior to that I really left it up to my friend to take care of the itinerary. And not that I wanted to sort of take a break or anything from the spiritual aspects of the trip, but I did sort of feel at that point in time that it would be nice to just have a rest.
Right, right.
And have someone else take care of the details.
Right.
And so we did things that were very much tourist-oriented things. We went to Agra, we saw the Taj Mahal, we visited Rajasthan, and visited the capital of Rajasthan, Jaipur. One of the places in Rajasthan that we did go to was a holy city called Pushkar.
Huh.
And Pushkar, the legends say, has a lake, and this lake was formed when one of Shiva's tears fell to earth. A lake was formed, and so it's a holy, sacred lake, and it is basically in the middle of the desert, so it's pretty amazing that there's a lake there. And all around the lake, there are what are called ghats, which are steps that go down to the water where different prayers can be said, and each ghat has its own name. And one of them is Gandhi Ghat, where Gandhi's ashes were actually sprinkled after his passing.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a beautiful place, absolutely gorgeous little town. And it was probably the first place where I really had a proper taste of spiritual India. The thing about it was that from the moment we went anywhere near a temple, and the Brahma temple was the main temple in town, I think the whole town has 1,500 different temples. And it's only a tiny little town, so you can imagine every sort of place you look, there's another temple.
Wow.
And that's incredible. And the Brahma temple is very beautiful. I don't really know how to say this, but basically from the minute we got there, we had Brahmins who are people who, are part of the Brahmin lineage and are holy men in the city, would approach myself or my friend and basically take us to different places within the temples where you could make offerings and say prayers, and you'd be given prayer sort of bands that go around your neck or around your wrists, which hold the vibration of the prayers, and you wear them until they fall off. But in Pushkar, there's a practice where once you've been through the Brahma temple, they take you down to the ghat, and someone passes you on to another Brahmin, and they begin saying prayers for you.
Huh.
And halfway into the prayers, they say, how many people are in your family? And you say, oh, 3 or 10 or whatever. And then they go about coercing you into donating a particular amount of money per person in your family.
Oh, I see.
So if you've got a really big family, you're kind of in really big trouble. any time people try and tell you that your prayers are only going to be answered if you provide this amount of money for them, my sort of intuitive faculties just go, can't do this.
Exactly.
Once you're actually in it, it's very, very difficult without being rude to say no.
Yeah.
And so you try and negotiate a prize, you know, which is just terrible. And you make your exits. And then, you know, you're kind of left with this not very nice feeling.
Yeah.
And then later on we met a genuine Brahmin who told us that all of the money that we gave didn't go to the families and children that money was meant to go to, because they say that, you know, that all the money that we give on behalf of our relatives goes to charity.
Uh-huh.
And then we found out later that none of that money goes to charity.
Right.
So it seems to be like an organized gang of Brahmins,
yeah,
basically, who take advantage of tourists there, which is really sad. And
yeah,
it was something that was echoed in a few other places that I went to. Went to another holy city called Haridwar on the Ganges, and the same sort of practices were practiced there. So, unfortunately, my exposure to genuine spiritual beings who lived and worked in India was very limited. I was very fortunate to meet a couple of people who really were completely authentic and were a total delight to meet. But in the general populace, I really didn't
get much
of a feeling of
yeah
their spirituality, except
yeah
in terms of their prayers to Ganesh, who is like the money god, and Hanuman. So,
well, we've
you know
got
what I mean?
We have our money gods over here, too, so...
Yeah.
All over the place.
So that was just my experience. I'm sure that other people have had other experiences, especially if they've gone and stayed in ashrams.
Yeah.
But... Well, that wasn't on our itinerary.
Why don't we jump over to Egypt then and talk about Egypt, because, you know, not too many of us will get to be able to see the pyramids and the Great Sphinx and feel those energies. Did you notice, what were your impressions when you first went to those areas?
It was really interesting. Again, because I was traveling as a woman alone, and in Egypt you are sort of warned before you go there that you've got to cover up and that the men can be a little bit aggressive and all that sort of stuff. I didn't really find that so much. But what I did find was I did meet some people who told me about some of the special power spots that you could go to at some of the different temples.
Mm.
And I went to the pyramids at Giza, of course, and that was incredible. But I didn't have the opportunity to go inside the Great Pyramid because it was Ramadan at the time that I was there, and there were no people working at the time that I was there, so I couldn't actually go in. But I did spend 4 days traveling along the Nile and visiting temples along the Nile. And I got to see Philae, which is where the temple of Isis is, or Isis. And that had a very amazing energy in one of the areas where Isis was said to have conceived Horus.
Uh-huh.
And Then I went to Edfu and Komombo, which were, Komombo is one of the temples where they revered the crocodile gods. And I was able to tune into some energies there that were very, very powerful. There's one place in, in Edfu, actually, there's a place where I was told you could go and stand on some steps and you'd feel like you were flying.
Oh.
And that was great. I was able to do that.
That's fun.
But for the most part, most of what I got out of going to those temples was about was really being able to look at the hieroglyphs and interpret them for myself. I felt that because there were a lot of tourists at the times when I was there, and I wasn't there with a group, say, you know, with a spiritual teacher who was leading meditations, the energy of the temples seems to shut down to a certain extent when the tourists are there and everyone's snapping their photos. I believe that the most potent energies can be accessed at these places when they're kind of closed for the day for the tourists.
But I'm
definitely wanting to develop my abilities to be able to tune into these energies at any time, because they are there. It's just a matter of you being able to be in resonance with those vibrations. And I believe that, you know, no matter when you go and whoever else is there, that if you're vibrating at a high enough frequency, then you should be able to pick up whatever it is that's there for you.
Yeah.
So that'll be something I do on my next trip to Egypt. but I just loved seeing the size of them and marveling at whose hands were responsible, what intelligences were involved in the creation of these amazing temples, and of course what the spiritual technologies were that were employed to build them.
Well, that still is a mystery, isn't it?
Pretty much.
A lot of people have theories that they claim are accurate, but, you know, nobody's actually been able to prove any of them.
No. But, you know, one day
the truth will become known.
And we already know that the key is vibration and frequency, and through the intelligent conscious use of vibration and frequency, these things were created.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we can speculate, we can aim to perceive whatever it is that we can pick up through our own intuitive faculties.
Right.
And have our theories, which are numerous.
Let's shift gears a little bit to kind of broaden this even further into the concept of us being running out of time. You know, that I know that you are, like me, looking into those various theories with the Mayan prophecies about 2012 and, you know, the various nights and days and so on. Where do you feel that we're at today with these energies? We entered the fifth night on November 19th, I believe, of last year. Where do you think we're headed in 2008, and do you think that 2012 is a turning point for us?
Well, as far as 2012 goes, I think that we're already experiencing whatever 2012 is supposedly all about now. If you think about a galactic timeline, the difference between the year 2008 and 2012 is, as the Pleiadians say, like a nanosecond. It's the most microscopic dot along that timeline. You can imagine. So we're already in that energy.
Okay.
And we're already being transformed, and we're experiencing shifts at every level of our being by these energies that are prevalent on the Earth right now. What we're doing is spiritualizing matter.
Yes.
And as we're doing this, openings are being created in our energetic fields, and things that I think that have been in shutdown or lockdown mode for a really long time are now available to us from our DNA and from our divine blueprint. And we're already navigating our way through making all of these new connections and I think that this year in particular, we're going to see a lot more of a shift in polarities. You know, for the last few years, people have basically been aligning themselves to the energies that they're most in resonance with, whether that's fear or whether that's love, essentially.
Right.
And so those who are really in resonance with those higher frequency energies are going to experience more of that.
Okay.
I've certainly been able to feel that much more in my own personal reality, that things are just flowing and there's a synchronicity and an ease and a joyfulness that accompanies my days.
Uh-huh.
But I'm also observing people around me who are, you know, maybe dealing with the real 3D sort of structures of the world and wondering how they're going to continue navigating their way through economic collapses or earth changes or whatever the manifestations are of the out, of these outer structures crumbling.
Right, right.
So there's going to be a real split, I think, a frequency split between those two groups and how they navigate their way through life over the next 12 months. And for some people, I think it's going to be terribly challenging. For other people, I think it's going to be incredibly empowering and enlightening, and hopefully those people will serve as the examples,
right?
Just through their beingness,
right,
for those who are finding it confusing,
right?
And as there are more and more beacons of light that are switched on in our world, then envisioning that they will serve as points of reference for those people who really need assistance. And the more that we can be of assistance and service and in compassion to those others, the better. So, I guess that's what I believe is happening in a nutshell.
Well, I certainly can say that I believe, I mean, I agree with everything you said and I'm aligned with it totally. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're living in really, really interesting times. And in terms of time, our consciousnesses are speeding up. Our vibration is expanding to such a level that we're now asking, you know, I think one of the things that Bev Wilson said in the interview that we did, she's from the Crystal Shop in Mount Shasta that you mentioned earlier. She said something really, really wonderful. She said, remember when we only had 6 colours of crayons to play with and when we wanted to make new colours, we'd have to, you know, colour one on top of the other to make a new colour.
Uh-huh.
And now when you go into a paint shop and you see the vast, infinitesimal numbers of shades that we're asking to live with, you can really see how our vibration is lifting and increasing. And as that happens, our perception of time is speeding up dramatically.
Huh.
So, you know, in some ways it's not really time that's speeding up, it's our perceptions, it's our vibration that's speeding up that's making time feel as though it's going really fast.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, interesting, interesting.
That's just what I think anyway.
Well, certainly.
And that's just what I think today. It could change tomorrow, you know. It's always evolving. It's always being expanded.
Yeah. I've noticed for myself that my own awareness seems to shift, like it comes and goes in slight circles or cycles or waves.
Mm.
And there will be like this ascension feeling of, you know, where I'm aware of certain things, I'm more conscious, and I have answers within. And then it lasts for a little while, and then it peters out, and I'm back to my old self again. I imagine that's just part of the process.
Oh, that's totally, totally normal. I think there's you know, it's almost like there's a broadcast that's gone through our universe.
Mm.
And it's a broadcast that's carrying the message to ascend, basically, to shift out of where we were at and to move into a new level of our beingness. And as this broadcast is literally hitting us at a cellular DNA level and at a quantum level, we're all kind of, the molecules have all been shifted around and they're still settling back down. You know what I mean? Into their new into their new configurations.
Yeah.
And so even the most enlightened beings that I think that are walking this planet at the moment are experiencing a little bit of disorientation or confusion and this vacillating energy between feeling completely in the flow to going back to, I don't know, just negative or fear consciousness.
Right.
Or, you know, here we are again, I'm back to responding to things and into old patterns that I thought I'd already cleared and healed.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just totally normal. I think we've just got to be present to whatever comes up, and if things come up and you become aware of old stuff again and you feel like maybe you've taken two steps back, just sit with whatever it is that's come up, and then as you sit with it, it will come up to be released and then it will pass, and then you can get back into that feeling of the flow again. And of course, incorporating a daily practice where you are spending some time within your inner being and exploring those realms is absolutely essential, and there just is no more time now for excuses. Everyone has to be working with some kind of a daily practice, because if you can do it now when things perhaps do become a little bit more chaotic as the year progresses, you will be so grateful that you've done this work at this time.
When you mention that, like a daily practice, are you suggesting things like meditation or prayer or, you know, going within and having some silent time with yourself? What are some of the...
Any and all. You know, body work is really important as well. It's great to do the meditation. It's great to... state your intentions or do whatever it is that you feel works for you best at the beginning or at the end of your days. But if you can do some body work, I can't emphasize how much more quickly the integrations will occur within your whole, you know, four-body system. So, any kind of body work, any kind of physical movement, even if it's just taking a nice walk in the park every day and exposing yourself to some nature, especially if you're working around computers and technology a lot of the time, we really, really need to give our bodies a chance to feel nature around us.
Right.
To counterbalance those electromagnetic frequencies. But meditation is definitely one of the best things that you can do. And if you can just fit in 5 minutes a day, that's going to be better than no minutes a day.
Well, I think one of the most important things that I think I've heard you say tonight is the value of learning how to listen to ourselves.
And it's all about listening and trusting and accepting.
Yeah.
Because there's the ego level of our being that wants to come in. If you get an intuitive impulse, say, oh, I'd really like to give this person that I love a beautiful present. And then the ego might come in and say, well, you've got no money, so you can't do that.
Right,
you know,
right.
And you limit your experience of life.
Right.
That ego level of your being wants to come in all the time and cut you down and cut you off from that inner resource that's so rich and just holds so much potential. So if you really start to just come from a place of accepting and trusting what you're receiving and then acting on that impulse, that's like the intuitive abilities we have are like the inner female, and that supporting and acting on that is like our inner male energy. And when they two work together and one is supporting the other, that's when you're really accessing the intelligence of your heart, and you know, from there you have access to the whole universe and
wow.
to your own God source.
Wow. Well, you know, that's a lot for all of us to take in. That was beautiful, Liz. You know, we're almost at the end of our hour. I should ask you, what's next in Liz's world? What do you see on the horizon? And also, how can folks get in touch with you? And where are you going to be at?
Okay. Well, at the moment, just doing all of the things that I was doing before I left to go overseas last year. I'm back DJing again around Melbourne. I present a radio show each week on Kiss FM here, a music radio show with a dear friend of mine, Peter Mack, and that can be heard every Thursday from 11 till 1 p.m. Melbourne time.
Okay.
And you can access that by checking out www.kissfm.com.au. That's Kiss, K-I-S-S, FM.com.au. And there's a live stream that you can tune into. I'm teaching yoga a couple of nights a week. I'm doing healing work. I was very fortunate enough to learn sound healing with Tom Kenyon when I was in the States recently, just before I came to see you.
Right,
and that's
right.
really taken on a really amazing life of its own, and I can't believe that I'm so comfortable with it. but it's just one of the best things that I could have done for myself. And coming up next month, I'll be taking a trip with a small group that has been called together by Lisa Renee, who is an incredible spiritual ascension guide and galactic emissary from the Sirius star system. And she's taking a group of us to Italy to a place called Damanhur. The temples of Damanhur are just a little while away, maybe half an hour away from the city of Turin. And these are some of the most incredible temple spaces that I've ever seen. It's a whole complex that's been built inside a mountain in northern Italy.
Wow.
And these are called the Temples of Humankind. Really, really worth going to have a look at them on the internet. Damanhur is spelled D-A-M-A-N-H-U-R. And please go and check out these incredible temples and what they do with them there. Lisa Renee is going to be taking us there for 8 days, and it's going to culminate on the night of the spring equinox in the Northern Hemisphere, which is Easter Sunday, or the night between Easter Saturday and Sunday, and we'll be spending a night in the Hall of Mirrors.
Wow.
And meditating and doing activations for the ascension of the planet.
Wonderful.
So I'm incredibly excited about this next phase and where that will take all of us. So,
well, Liz,
yeah,
I want to thank
it.
You. Thank you very much for being on the show. Is there any place where you wanted for people to reach you, or a website? Before we
sure.
have to sign off?
You can contact me either by going to my podcast page, which is lizmiller.podomatic.com. That's LIZMILLAR.PODOMATIC.com. Or you can go to myspace.com/LizMusic, which is spelled LIZMUZIK. So thank you so much, Lance. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, you too. You too. And we'll do it again when we'll have to hear the next stories.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you again, and many blessings on your way.
Blessings to you too. Good night, everybody.